interview with Mrs. Ella L. Anderson, interviewed by Denise L. Foster Bay for the Black Oral History of Bridgeport Project of the Afro-American Educators Association. Mrs. Anderson, can you tell us a little bit about your early childhood, where you were born, and your birthday? The story of your birthday was interesting.
I was born in Petersburg, Virginia, really of a family of five of us. My grandmother delivered all of us, and she happened to have gotten our birth dates mixed up. She has my brother, my sister, and myself all the same age, and I was definitely born July 4th, 1917, in Petersburg, Virginia.
And she has you down as being born?
July 7th, 1914. And that is the way that it is recorded in the U.S. Census.
So you get an extra 3 years.
Right.
Good. Can you tell me a little bit about what life was like growing up in Virginia?
Well, I had a beautiful life, I think, in West Virginia. I was lucky enough to, after my mother and father died, to become a part of a household of an aunt of mine, who was really just like a mother. And they sent me to school, and that's where I got my education in West Virginia, where they lived. And they were really just like parents. I really didn't even know I didn't have a mother or father, because of the way that I was reared. It's a beautiful life as far as how we were reared in that kind of way. At the time I was in West Virginia, we didn't have many things like we thought we would have in some other country or some other city. My aunt, of course, never knew what prejudice was, as far as she knew. That there was such a thing as prejudice, but she didn't know it. I recognized it as a youngster. And I recognized it one Sunday morning when she became ill, and she asked me to take her to a little town not too far from us, in a place called Oak Hill, West Virginia. And I took her there to the drugstore and to get some medicine. And she was so sick she couldn't stand, so I asked her to sit. And the minute she sat in the chair, the manager said, "Oh, you can't sit there. You know, black people couldn't sit down." And this stuck with me over a few years.
Was the community where your aunt lived an all-black community?
We lived in a little town called Greentown. That's what they call it. A little out of town from the city of Oak Hill. All white people lived in Oak Hill. We lived in a little town called Greentown. And of course we commuted back and forth, or we walked back and forth to Oak Hill to do whatever kind of shopping that we had to do.
And where did you go to school?
I went to school in a place called Whipple, West Virginia. That's where I went to elementary school. Whipple, West Virginia. That was when they closed the school in Greentown where we live, but we did have a school there. And I went there in kindergarten, first grade. And the reason why I went to the other town was because they closed this particular school down.
And these are all black schools?
All black schools. We had nothing but black schools in West Virginia that black children could attend. You know, the white kids went to the white schools, black kids went to the black schools. This is the way it was at that time.
Now you went to college also in West
Virginia. Yes, but in between college, you see, I did not go to high school. Well, in West Virginia, so to speak, it was West Virginia, but it was Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. I did not go to the public elementary schools in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. I was sent to a high school. And of course, Harpers Ferry is right outside of Washington, D.C. It's closed now. Mm-hmm. But that's where I got my high school education, in Harpers Ferry. And then after I finished Harper Ferry, I went to West Virginia State College.
Major.
As I was saying, I went to Stuart College, Harper Ferry, West Virginia, and that is now historical.
The college, or?
It was a college, but they also had high school.
High school.
Yes.
And Harper's Ferry is, what, John Brown?
Where John Brown's fort is located. And, of course, right now it's a historical park.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the very best schools at the time that we had, because I remember when I went to West Virginia State, they thought I was a pretty smart kid.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had to have an average of 75 before we could pass at Stuart College. You know, you have to make 75.
75 all the time.
Right.
I wish we could have that now.
Right, right.
What was it like going to an all-black school?
Well, I thought it was fantastic. We learned, I have never regretted one day of having gone to a black school, because we were able to become presidents of our class. We were able to do so many different things that you don't even get exposed to when you go to a white school. And I have missed a thing. And another thing that I really enjoyed doing was the fact that we were taught black history. And it was part of our curriculum.
It was just a natural.
It was a natural thing for us to take talk about black history. It wasn't a big issue. It was part of our curriculum.
Mrs. Anderson, after college, you said that you taught for 15 years in West Virginia.
Yes,
at a black school, elementary school, high school?
Yes, I did. I first started out the first year when I finished college. I substituted in high school, and that was 1 year. The second year, and at that time jobs were hard to get. In the second year I was out of school, I got a job teaching at a little elementary school so far down under the mountain that you had to go down on one of these sliding, you know, one of the sliding, I don't know what they call them now, what they would call them.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get on it and they let you down the hill.
Or like a lift.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Right. They let you down that hill, and then when you get to the bottom of the hill, you get off, and this is flat land down here. So that was the first school where I taught. And it was sitting right on a riverbank.
Mm-hmm.
And in the morning, if it were so that we went down on the train, I would get off at the train, and we had to go across a swinging bridge. And this is when I would almost go berserk. Across the swinging bridge, and inches, about 6 inches worth of space, and the river down, you know, and the bridge swinging.
That's some dedication.
So I was there 1 year, and they claimed, well, the superintendent of schools claimed that I did such a terrific job with the kids, he decided to move me to another school, which was one of the best schools that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a four-room elementary. The one I was teaching in was a one-room. And I had a class of 60 children.
Wow.
And I taught every subject from K through 8th grade. And every one of them learned how to read. That's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, when I was moved to the so-called better school, there were four rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And I had one subject then. I had one grade. I had fourth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very, very, very... it was a good setup that they had there. And we had a hot lunch program, and we had a lot of good things going for the kids. We were able to give affairs where we could get whatever we needed for our school. You know, at that time, they didn't have anything in the classroom for you. They would say, here is your school. This is your room. You can do anything that's legal to get anything in this room that you need. So we would give on Friday nights, we would always give a dance concert. We called it well, a Jennifer bug contest then. And we raise money and buy books for the school. Any kind of mimeographing materials that we need. We buy just any kind of supplies that we need. We did that every Friday night. Mm-hmm. And I would put on what you call talent shows.
Right.
And we raised money then.
Now, you started teaching during the Depression or just before the Depression?
I taught during the Depression. Mm-hmm. I taught at a time when people were in bread lines, when children didn't have shoes to put on their feet. And I have taken much of my salary many times and bought my children shoes to put on their feet.
What was the salary like then?
I got, the first year I taught, I got $100 a month. And the next year I taught, I got $110 a month. And the last year I taught, I got $375 a month. That was over a span of 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
But we bought everything we needed with that $110.
Mm-hmm.
We had cars just like we have now. We bought anything we wanted. We called ourselves dressing well. We did everything for that $110. And we still had some money out of the $110 that we could put in the bank and save a few pennies. Mm-hmm.
How did the black community in West Virginia fare during the Depression?
I think they did very well because, first of all, they had land. Mm-hmm. They could grow crops. And a lot of them canned their food and they preserved. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't see much of a breadline.
Mm-hmm.
Really, what we saw at the time were people who lived in the area where they had coal, in the coal fields, mm-hmm. as we call them, where people didn't own their homes.
Mm-hmm.
You see everybody in West Virginia try to own a home, except those who work in the mines. And of course, they live in the mining houses. Mm-hmm. And when they are not working, of course, they're not, you know, making any money. The company's making all the money. But we did have some tough times with kids at the time. But one thing about it, the kids couldn't afford, now they do now furnish materials and furnish books and things, but at that time the children had to buy their own books.
Right.
They bought their own sets of books,
mm-hmm.
and the school furnished nothing. Everything they had to buy.
Themselves.
Yeah.
So if they didn't have any money, it was difficult. Just,
exactly. It was difficult.
Did any of your family, now you said you were born in 1914, and that was during World War I, did any of your family participate in World War I?
I had a brother, I would say a brother, sort of a, not a blood kin brother.
Mm-hmm.
I had cousins,
mm-hmm.
but not very, too many close relatives that I have to be in the war at that time.
Do you remember any stories or impressions that they might have mentioned about their experience in World War I?
No, I can't remember one thing.
Yeah.
Maybe I was too young.
Too young, yeah.
this is what I go by.
Yeah.
I was probably too young.
So the Depression was really when you were really aware of things that were going on,
exactly.
because you were part of it.
Yeah.
How about World War II? Where were you in World War II?
In World War II, I was in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
I was still teaching in West Virginia. Well, I got married during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
I got married back in 1943.
Mm-hmm.
And I was teaching in West Virginia at the time.
How did World War II change living conditions and things in West Virginia, or for you personally?
Well, for me personally, things were about the same. I was still teaching. The only thing that I noticed particularly, that I was able to help many of the people who were in the coal mining field, I was able to help them to do a lot of things. They used to cry because we had rationing of sugar. They couldn't find their stockings. They couldn't find food, they couldn't find their pork, and because all of this was sent overseas,
mm-hmm.
they couldn't get many of the types of foods that they would enjoy. But but we would try to encourage them and help them as much as we possibly could. But what I did really during the war was to work on a defense plan.
Mm-hmm. Well, you did.
Between times of teaching. I worked at a defense plant up in Elkton, Maryland, and we gauged the shells,
mm-hmm.
long shells, something 6 or 8 inches long, and that was my job. I was gauging those to see that if they fit perfectly mm-hmm. into the gun
mm-hmm.
that was being shot overseas.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice migration from West Virginia, or migration starting, people leaving West
yes.
Virginia and going north?
Yes, they did. They went where they could find the jobs. Many of them went to Elkton, Maryland. Many of them went to other places where there were defense plants.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you could just see that. And then, of course, a lot of them who wanted to be there working in the mines, you know, the jobs there became more important
mm-hmm.
then. In fact, there were more jobs. The mines began to open up.
Yeah.
Yes, and work. So the people would go back. They made excellent money working in the coal mine.
Mm-hmm.
So they really weren't to the people who had been there and had received the salaries and all that they were getting. They weren't too anxious to leave. So they stayed.
Mm-hmm. Were there recruiters coming down?
Not too many.
Mm-hmm.
Not too many.
So when did you come to Bridgeport?
I came to Bridgeport in 1952.
Mm-hmm.
And after I married, my family and I were talking about our children. If we had children and we felt that the schools and the educational facilities and all would be better if we were to move someplace else. And many of us who were in school, we were told many times that the East offered quite a bit. And so we said, let's go up and visit. So we came up and we visited and we spent the summer we were here quite a while. And we stayed in downtown at the Stratfield Motor Inn.
Mm-hmm.
And from all indications that we had when we came here, we thought that Bridgeport was an ideal place. Our visit showed no prejudice,
mm-hmm.
nothing. It was just simply beautiful. So we went back home, and we came here to this very house,
mm-hmm.
and talking to some people downtown at the Stratfield Home Inn, we said, gee whiz, we would love to move to this area. So what we did, we had Mr. Robert Turner, who was a mortician here,
mm-hmm.
lived on Stratford Avenue, and he showed us around in Bridgeport, and he brought us to this house. And showed us the outside. He said, there's a house for sale. And we looked at this house. And when we went back to the hotel, the man who owned the house was at the hotel. And he said he would bring us out here and show us this house. And he did.
Was this a white man?
White man.
He had no problems with black family moving
into
his house.
Well, I think that really what happened, and he admitted that the neighbors may not be too friendly because they weren't too particular about blacks moving in.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that. When we moved in this house, we did not know at the time, I did not know until 10 years later, that some people down the street from me carried the petition around to keep us out of the house. And I was sitting in the yard one afternoon, and one of my other neighbors said to me, Ella, you see the lady going down the street? She is famous for carrying petitions. And she came to my yard and said they wanted to put a playground on the end of the street over on the other side for children. Well, only people in the neighborhood who had children were only about 5 or 6 of us. So we wanted, fine, it would be fine for our children. But this lady didn't have children. And so we said to her, we're not going to sign the petition. When we have children,
mm-hmm.
we want the children to have a playground. So then my other neighbor said, Ella, don't sign the petition. because she's the one who brought the petition around you here 10 years ago to keep you people out, and we thought that something else.
Yeah. She could turn to you and to help another time, right?
That's right. Mm. Yeah, show you how things happen. And of course, when we were here, the welcome wagon was supposed to come around to invite us into the community. I didn't know that until I went to the bank downtown here, and I walked in one day, and the lady said, "Did the welcome wagon come to your house?" And I said, "Welcome wagon? No, I haven't seen the welcome wagon." He said, "Well, the lady was supposed to come to you. Your house." So I haven't heard a thing about it. We haven't heard a thing about a welcome wagon yet. And that's been 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. You're going to welcome some people.
Yeah, right.
How did your son find, or how did you find the school system in Stratford for your son at that time?
Well, my son never had a problem. He never had a problem. I never had a problem with him in school. Everything was just grand. I never had a problem with my neighbors. My son not getting along with the other children. He always made friends. In fact, he is the one, my son is the one, who made it possible for my neighbors and myself to become closer. Mm-hmm. Because he went in every home and learned every name and said, "I want my mother to meet you. I like you."
Mm-hmm.
This is what my son would say. And he was only 2 years old.
Children
and women. Yeah, right. And he traveled from one house to the other. Over here, there. And it was, at the time, there was a house there for the sick people. I don't know what, I forget what they called. But anyway, it was a house over there. And he was a little boy. He would go over there and talk to those sick patients every morning, those old ladies.
Mm-hmm.
He was a little boy. And those old ladies wouldn't even eat their breakfast in the morning until this little boy would come over and tell them, "Let's eat breakfast. It's time to eat breakfast." Chris Rayfield, really, he was a terrific kid. And the same way over here, he would sit in the window and he'd watch them. He would call, "This is my Uncle George. Mother, I want you to meet my Uncle George." He was terrific.
Yeah.
Terrific. So children can really do a lot.
They can make it, yeah.
Yeah.
When you moved to Stratford, was there a large black community in the South End as there is today?
No. When I first moved to Stratford, there were not too many black people here. They just started moving in. In fact, I remember when I first came to Bridgeport, I would go downtown, and I would be downtown sometimes all day long, and I didn't see two black people.
Mm-hmm.
I would go to town every day just to be going because I was lonesome. My husband was working, and I'd just go downtown to look around. Sometimes I didn't see a black person all day long. So that shows you how many are here now.
Right. When you moved to Bridgeport, you didn't immediately start working?
I didn't work in Bridgeport. I was here for about 15 years before
I started teaching.
Right.
Uh-huh. And you were just at home?
I was just at home all that time, working with community groups. I worked with every community group you can mention.
Mm-hmm.
I worked with everything I worked with. Red Cross, cancer, everything. I'd go to house, knocking on doors, mm-hmm. ringing for money for cancer, for Red Cross, for Muscle, everything.
Mm-hmm.
Everything. So I have worked with everything that I can think of, and I belong to so many different groups that I worked with. Mm-hmm. I actively worked with. I worked with the Council of Churches for about 10 or 12 years, mm-hmm. and I worked up to be the first vice president, and we didn't have too many black people in that at the time. So I've worked with everything. And then, of course, I found the time to be on some boards. I was appointed by Governor Dempsey to serve on the state board of the Scholarship mm-hmm. Commission,
mm-hmm.
and also the Community College.
Mm-hmm.
I was on the board of Community College, and I served there for quite a while on the on the scholarship commission and on the community college. Mm-hmm. And I'd commute back and forward to Hartford all the time, mm-hmm. to do that.
To do that.
Right. So I would, that's the way I spent my time. And then, of course, I became president of NAACP.
Right.
And before I became president of NAACP, I worked with Reverend Johnson, Reverend William O. Johnson. Mm-hmm. I worked with him on the Freedom Fund of NAACP. He was president at the time. And then I became president after mm-hmm. he went out. And I served there for 6 years, and I served as the state conference president for a couple of years.
Now, during the 60s, the entire United States was in an upheaval. The civil rights movement was really in full swing. How was Bridgeport during that time? How involved were people in Bridgeport in civil rights activities here in the city and nationally?
Well, I'll tell you about Bridgeport. Nationally, everybody had it together. But Bridgeport didn't have it together. I remember when we first had a demonstration in Bridgeport because of conditions. People said everything. It was hard to even get black people to join you to march around City Hall. People were very complacent. Those of us who wanted to do something, they would tell us we were too militant. Bridgeport was conservative. They wanted you not to talk too loudly. They wanted you to play down issues. This is a fact. And what had happened, I think, in the past is that everybody just, the people who lived here just didn't realize that there was a problem in Bridgeport. But they had problems. But they didn't realize that they had problems in Bridgeport. They always say, we didn't have any problems until the Southerners came here.
Mm-hmm.
But they had problems, but they didn't recognize them. We can recognize our problems wherever we go. In the South, we recognize problems. You know, nobody has to say to you, we have a problem, because we know it.
Mm-hmm.
When you come to Bridgeport and they say to you, you know, I found out when we moved here, when you couldn't buy a house where you wanted to buy, right off the bat. That was 30-some years ago. And yet they were saying to us, oh, honey, you can buy any place you please. But it was not true. You could not buy a house where you please. You could not get a job where you wanted to work. You could not do many things in Bridgeport that people who lived here thought that they could do. And I think that the Southern people who came into Bridgeport made it very clear that many things were denied people who lived here. And I think that later on they found this out.
Mm-hmm.
Because a good example is in, I hate to even mention this, good example was in the idea when Geraldine Johnson, even later on, all the years down, when Geraldine Johnson wanted to run for get superintendent job in Bridgeport, and how they did this.
Mm-hmm. All right.
You see what mm-hmm. I'm saying? Geraldine Johnson was the person who was qualified for that. But look what happened. It was either she was a woman or she was black, and I think it was both.
She had the double whammy. Yeah.
You see, so that's a good example years later.
Right.
John Lancaster's another. John Lancaster was a lawyer. They kept saying he could not become a lawyer because he couldn't pass the bar. All the rest of the dummies passed the bar. Mm-hmm. Excuse me for saying it. Mm-hmm. But they all passed the bar. They didn't have any problems. But John Lancaster was kept back. This is a good example of what happened. And you can just go right on down the line and see that it was really racial discrimination.
When you got to Bridgeport, now, some of the other interviews that we've done, people spoke about not being able to eat in certain places in Bridgeport. And many of the women could only get jobs in some of the department stores running the elevators. Was this still so when you were